Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You're confident when it comes to your work and life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same confidence when it comes to refinancing your existing mortgage or buying a home. It lets you understand all the details so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions was hot under the collar yesterday about the suggestion he had anything to do with Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election campaigns. But he was tight-lipped when the questioning got tough before the Senate Intelligence Committee. This hour On Point, Jeff Sessions' testimony, what we learned and what we didn't. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Did Jeff Sessions enlighten you yesterday? Did he enlighten our understanding of what went on? Did he light the way ahead? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll look at Senate Republicans' closed-door drafting of a new health care plan for America. But first, Attorney General Jeff Sessions' testimony. Here he was. Yesterday, vehemently denying having worked with Russians in any way during the Trump campaign before the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing.
The suggestion that I participated in any collusion, that I was aware of any collusion with the Russian government to hurt this country, which I have served with honor for 35 years, or to undermine the integrity of our democratic process, is an appalling and detestable lie.
Appalling and detestable lie. Joining me now from Washington is Jonathan Landay, national security reporter for Reuters. Jonathan, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What did we learn, what did we not yesterday from Attorney General Sessions?
Well, I'm not sure we learned anything except for the fact that he was disputing some key sections of former FBI Director James Comey's testimony before the same committee last week. But what really struck me was sort of the excerpt that you played, and that's because I'm not aware of anyone making any suggestions or any allegations that Jeff Sessions indulged in collusion or even was suspected of indulging in collusion or knew that there had been any collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. My understanding, and the way I was seeing this, is that he was called to testify about the fact that he had originally denied having any contacts with the Russians, and then eventually, and that was during his confirmation hearing, and then eventually he wrote a letter to the committee admitting that he had actually had two interactions. And if you take those and place them in the larger setting of what were administration denials of any contacts with the Russians originally, President Trump's assurances and insistence that there were no contacts with the Russians between his campaign and Russian officials. And then gradually we learned that, in fact, there were. And I myself reported a couple of weeks ago that, in fact, there had been multiple undisclosed contacts between the president's one of his closest advisors, Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, and the Russian ambassador. And so that is the way, I mean, that was how I was looking at this, among other things, is how is he going to explain that? How is he going to explain the fact that he originally said he had had no contacts and then eventually had to come out and say in this letter that, in fact, he did have several contacts, one in his office and one at the Republican National Convention?
So, but I got the impression from Sessions yesterday, he was saying, well, I was at, I don't know, cocktail parties or something. The Russian ambassador might have been there. What's the big deal? Is that a fair depiction?
Basically, what he was saying is he can't remember whether or not he had any interactions with the Russians at this April. The president then GOP candidate Trump's first foreign policy address. It took place in April 2016 at the Mayflower Hotel here in Washington, D.C., and there was a reception for people who were invited, and certainly the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kiselyak, was there. There are photographs of him in the audience, and that is where, you know, there have been reports that perhaps the two of them had an undisclosed meeting during this event at the Mayflower Hotel, which Mr. Sessions came out and said, well, he didn't have any meetings with Russian officials at the hotel. But then he said, you know, if there were any interactions in passing with the Russian ambassador, I don't remember it, he said. He didn't remember, or at least he said he couldn't recall any. And so I think that was the main question, is whether or not he had been truthful when he eventually came to the committee after his confirmation and said he had had two interactions.
The word recall, or words I can't recall, seemed to come up frequently, but there was also a blanket denial of wrongdoing. Here was Sessions.
Let me state this clearly, colleagues. I have never met with or had any conversation with any Russians or any foreign officials concerning any type of interference with any campaign or election in the United States. Further, I have no knowledge of any such conversations by anyone connected to the Trump campaign.
Nothing, never, ever, Sessions said yesterday, but there was a lot of concern from senators who did not feel he was forthcoming on the details that might flesh out the picture. And I want to listen to some of that. Stick with us, Jonathan Landay. Jennifer Rubin from The Washington Post joins us in a moment. But this was Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon saying, we've got stonewalling here again.
I believe the American people have had it with stonewalling. Americans don't want to hear that answers to relevant questions are privileged and off limits, or that they can't be provided in public, or that it would be, quote, inappropriate for witnesses to tell us what they know.
I am not stonewalling. I am following the historic policies of the Department of Justice. You don't walk into any hearing or committee meeting and reveal confidential communications with the President of the United States, who's entitled to receive confidential communications in your best judgment about a host of issues.
Okay. Stonewalling, the charge of stonewalling. Did you see it, Jonathan, yesterday?
Stonewalling. Yes, I did. I mean, yes, I watched that. And, you know, what you had was the Attorney General citing what he said was a longstanding executive branch-wide practice of not discussing before Congress conversations with the President of the United States. Now, the Department of Justice points to Reagan administration era documents that they claim substantiate this, but experts that I've talked to, there have been lawmakers as well, said they are unaware of any kind of hard and fast Department of Justice rules limiting the ability of the Attorney General or other senior officials to discuss conversations with the President in circumstances where the President himself has not invoked executive privilege, and that did not happen yesterday. President Trump did not invoke executive privilege. Mr. Sessions insisted that, in fact, what he was doing was preserving the ability of the President in the future to invoke executive privilege and safeguard those conversations. And that was where I was going next. And that was the other major question here was we know that the Attorney General recused himself from any involvement in the Justice Department FBI counterintelligence investigation of Russian interference in the election. And so there was a major question as to how it was he came to recommend the firing of the former director of the FBI, James Comey. And when the questioning got to that area, he continued to invoke this rule he claimed, these rules from the Department of Justice that prevented him from discussing communications with the president. And he got so specific on that that he even refused to discuss whether or not the president, per James Comey's testimony, had said to him and others in an Oval Office meeting, please leave, I want to talk to the director of the FBI by myself. He even refused to say whether or not the president had said that, only saying that when he got up and left the Oval Office, only James Comey was sitting there.
Not going to talk about it. Jonathan Landau with Reuters Standby. Jennifer Rubin joins us from the Washington Post. She writes the Right Turn conservative essay there. Jennifer Rubin, thank you very much for being with us.
Nice to be here.
All right. You were watching as a conservative denizen of Washington who's been watching all of what's going on. Did you feel that Jeff Sessions sort of hot under the collar delivery yesterday was justified? Did he answer the question? Did he share what Americans in the Senate committee need to know?
He did lose his cool several times. He did not share what he knew. And I think it was a travesty, just as I thought when Admiral Rogers and Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats came up with this, I rather not tell you kind of response. There is a assumption, there is a understanding in our constitutional system that Congress has the right of oversight. And when you're called to testify and testify under oath, you have an obligation, unless you're going to invoke a recognized privilege or assert the Fifth Amendment, that you will testify completely. These people are acting in a contemptuous manner towards a co-equal branch of Congress. And I don't think they should allow it. I think they should bring these people back and proceed with contempt proceedings. But this ground sheet is not going to work with the special prosecutor, Mueller. He knows the law. If these people won't respond, he's going to stick them in front of a grand jury and direct them to answer and hold them in contempt if they don't. And there, they're going to have to answer all of these questions. I would point out that there's something I think the senators do not understand and much of the press do not understand.
Okay. Yeah?
The recusal by Jeff Sessions was much broader than just Russian interference. If you look at the language of that recusal, it's any investigation or matter stemming from the 2016 presidential campaign.
Yeah.
Even the reason he stated for terminating Mr. Comey, which we think was false.
How he handled Hillary Clinton's case, yeah.
That's the subject.
That's
of the
part
refusal.
Of it.
So what the heck was he doing involving himself in that?
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Attorney General Jeff Sessions, combative, defensive, before the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday, and his testimony there with Jennifer Rubin, conservative blogger, columnist for The Washington Post. She writes the Right Turn blog there. And Jonathan Landau, who covers national security for Reuters. They've both been paying a lot of attention to this. You can join us this hour. Were you persuaded that the allegations around Jeff Sessions are a detestable lie? And was Sessions stonewalling on his interactions with the president of the United States? Is the attorney general representing the country or the president here? What's his job? 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. He talked about his recusal. He said, look, I did it for my honor.
I recused myself from any investigation into the campaign for president, but I did not recuse myself from defending my honor against scurrilous and false allegations.
Didn't recuse himself from defending his honor. And here, saying, look, it's absurd to say that he shouldn't be involved with Comey, the FBI, the way the whole department's managed. Here he was.
It is absurd, frankly, to suggest that a recusal from a single specific investigation would render the Attorney General unable to manage the leadership of the various Department of Justice law enforcement components that conduct thousands of investigations.
Jonathan Landay, did that come across as credible yesterday? Jennifer Rubin says, look at the language of the recusal. He wasn't supposed to touch anything to do with 2016. And the first thing he mentioned was, when they asked him, well, why did you recommend Comey's firing, was Hillary Clinton. And of course, that was right in the middle of the campaign. Was it credible, this distinction?
Again, I don't think it was, simply because Mr. Comey had been told by the President of the United States on a number of occasions that he had confidence in him, and he would be staying on at his job at the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And then suddenly you had that recommendation that went to Trump for his recommending that he be dismissed over his handling, as you point out, of the Hillary Clinton email case. And then you had the President of the United States admitting in a television interview that, in fact, no, he had been thinking about the Russia investigation when he fired Mr. Comey. And so there is this cognitive dissonance between what Mr. Sessions said yesterday and what the President said his reasons for firing Mr. Comey were. One other thing, just very quickly.
Yeah.
In fact, as Jennifer pointed out, in public, the head of the NSA, Admiral Rogers, declined to testify, but he did go back to the Senate Intelligence Committee on Monday evening for almost 2 hours to testify to the committee behind closed doors, of course, about on the questions that he was asked and declined to answer last week.
I want to listen to this one exchange between Ron Wyden of Oregon, Senator, and Sessions yesterday. Of course, last week we saw James Comey there, and he suggested that the FBI sort of saw it coming that Sessions would recuse himself because, in addition to what was out there, there were other things that would make that, I guess, necessary. And Jennifer Rubin, Jonathan, listen to this exchange with us for a second. Ron Wyden, Senator Wyden, and Attorney General Sessions.
Mr. Comey said that there were matters with respect to the recusal that were problematic and he couldn't talk about them. What are they?
Why don't you tell me? They are none, Senator Wyden. There are none. I can tell you that for absolute certainty. This is a secret innuendo being leaked out there about me, and I don't appreciate it. And I've tried to give my best and truthful answers to any committee I've appeared before. And it's really people are suggesting through innuendo that I have been not honest about matters. And I've tried to be honest.
All right, Jennifer Rubin, this was one of those moments where, just as a citizen watching this, I don't know what to think. We had James Comey, the fired director of the FBI, saying very plainly there was something more. I can't talk about it, but it was important enough that others in the senior levels of the FBI saw a recusal coming. Jeff Sessions saying, nada, nothing. What are we to make of this, Jennifer?
I suppose that Sessions wouldn't know what the problem was because Comey's the one who made a decision, apparently, or others in the Justice Department made a decision that there is some involvement he has, or he is in some sort of position that makes it impossible for him to oversee the investigation.
Well, how could Sessions not know that? I mean,
he may not understand, frankly, that lying to the Senate Judiciary Committee could be seen as obstruction of justice, for example. He doesn't seem to realize that his conduct in and of itself may be part of an additional investigation into obstruction. And I do want to point something out.
Yes.
I don't think he gets what it means to recuse himself. He is reasoning backwards. I have to be able to oversee my department. Therefore, the recusal cannot mean that I don't get to investigate and dismiss the FBI director. That's wrong. A recusal is an area of your responsibilities that you may not enter. I don't think he took it seriously. I don't think he knew what it meant. And I think his entire attitude is sort of contemptuous. I get to do my job regardless of what this recusal says. I'm not really going to tell you what I think the recusal meant, but I know I could do my job. And that's just not the way it works. That's not how a recusal operates. His failure to abide by that, yeah. His lack of candor in front of Congress, and his lack of candor in filling out his request, his application for security clearance, is all terribly germane to this investigation. And the fact that he doesn't recognize it or realize what he's done is a problem doesn't really impress me. It kind of reinforces this notion that he's essentially clueless.
Let me bring our callers in, if I may. South Dakota, Aberdeen, South Dakota. John's calling. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
Okay, what do you see?
Well, looking at it, you know, it's just kind of a troubling series of similar events with, you know, the president asking James Comey for loyalty, and then Jeff Sessions saying that his loyalty is to the president, why he's not talking. Kind of a skewed view of loyalty compared to, you know, to the president compared to the U.S. people, and it makes the administration look a little more monarchical than it probably should for this country.
So there's a relationship issue there, or an understanding of job problem in your view. What about truth? Do you think we were getting it yesterday, John?
I don't really think so, and I think I'm kind of curious how long it's going to, you know, partisan politics are going to play before people are so fed up that, you know, I'm curious to see what happens.
Let me get one. John, I appreciate your call from South Dakota. One more right here from Moortown, Vermont. Gene, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Yeah, this is just a total witch hunt, Tom. They have nothing. This has been going on for, 9 months now for this nonsense. Sessions was totally honest. Comey came up and made believe there was something nefarious going on. He'd have to talk about it in closed session. In a closed session, he talked about a possible meeting at this Mayflower Hotel, which was a reception with dozens of people at the reception. Tom, you have lots of Trump haters on, from Jack Beatty on, Tom. Even the way you slanted, I just see Trump hating. And this is what this is all about.
But here's the deal, Gene. This is, I mean, we've got our intelligence community and the director former of the FBI saying we've got a deep assault on a primary function of democracy, our elections. And we need to understand that. And we're looking for officials to be forthcoming to help us.
But why is it hard to understand that he can't repeat conversations that he has with the president?
Yes, he can. I mean, you say he can't, but that in itself is disputed. And is that really more important than us knowing what happened with our elections? But I appreciate your call, though, Gene. Jonathan, Gene sees it as a witch hunt. And so, I mean, that's the same phrase Donald Trump has used about this. There's a kind of cognitive dissonance here for American people when you've got high officials in places where they ought to know a lot saying we've got a fundamental threat to our democracy. On the other hand, you've got the president and here Gene saying witch hunt.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's what the president has been. That's the key word he's been using. They even used it in a fundraising appeal yesterday. But the fact is that there are troubling aspects to all of this. One of the things that I would point to is that there is, in fact, a criminal grand jury that has been sitting in Alexandria, Virginia, that's looking into the president's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn. And the unreported money that he took from both Russian state television and from an American Turkish businessman. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars. We know that there are investigations going on into the president's, to Paul Manafort, who served briefly as a couple of months as the CEO of the president's campaign last year.
Yep.
One of the other things that I think which brings up more cognitive dissonance is you had the Attorney General of the United States yesterday. This, I think, was one of the most amazing revelations, actually, that perhaps I should have brought up at the beginning of the program,
okay.
Who admits that he has never been briefed. He has never requested, nor has he received, a classified briefing on the fact that the intelligence community determined that Russia, a foe of the United States, interfered in a very serious manner with American democracy in the form of this influence campaign, fake news, hacking. We now know close to 40 state entities involved in putting on in holding the elections last year, that the Attorney General seems to think that his recusal covers the fact that he doesn't need to know about Russian espionage in the United States. I thought that was a pretty amazing revelation.
Jennifer Rubin, come in here. I mean, as a conservative watching all this, you've got, in effect, with that, Jeff Sessions saying, I guess this is not a big priority for me. What do you make of that? Our caller says witch hunt. The president says witch hunt.
Well, I think it's appalling that, as Jonathan said, there seems to be a dearth of interest, not only from Jeff Sessions, but we heard from Mr. Comey that Donald Trump, the president of the United States, has never asked about it, shows no interest in this whatsoever. And this, I think, is the narcissism that has enveloped the White House, that it's all about Trump. The only meaning of the Russia investigation, the Russia hacking, the Russian espionage, the Russian attack on our democracy, is that it is, in his view, delegitimizing his presidency. He has no concern for the United States. He has no concern for our democracy. That is really an appalling dereliction of duty. And I think whether you're conservative, whether you're liberal, whether you're moderate, whether you're agnostic, that should really concern you. It's an admission that he is not fulfilling his role as commander-in-chief. And that really goes to his fitness for duty, the fitness of all these people to hold high office. If you cannot admit and you cannot reckon with the worst assault on American democracy, the worst assault on America since 9/11, that was the way Angus King, I think, rightly put it yesterday, then I don't think you have any business being in office.
What creeps me out is we have more elections coming. We need to get our head around this, our arms around it, and resolve it. You know, it's 2017 now, 2018, big elections, 2020, another presidential election. David in Oklahoma City. David, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I was just absolutely blown away yesterday by the absurdity of Sessions' answers or refusal to answer. And in particular, I don't know how many times he invoked, I don't recall, I don't remember, but when it suited his purpose, he had very keen memory of events. And to me, he and Rogers and the rest are just making a mockery of the Senate Investigative Committee. And as an American citizen, I want answers. I want to know, you know, witch hunt is a joke. It's just, you know, smoke and mirrors. If that were the case, why are they hiding everything? And it always comes up after the fact. I mean, Sessions forgot about meetings, really?
David, we got it. I mean, he was saying yesterday, I'm not hiding. There wasn't anything. There's nothing to talk about here. But as to why he wouldn't get into details, I want to ask both of you, Jennifer and Jonathan. And David, thank you for your call from Oklahoma. But about this exchange with Kamala Harris, Senator, Democrat of California, former Attorney General in California herself, so it's sort of a prosecutor's way of going at this. But there was this exchange. Interesting, she got interrupted here by John McCain kind of coming in to defend his, old friend Jeff Sessions. That's unusual in itself. But she was trying to press in. This might be more the kind of, you tell us, Jonathan, but this might be more the kind of questioning that Sessions would face if he ever comes before Bob Mueller. Here was the California senator and Jeff Sessions pressing on why he wouldn't say more. Is there a policy? What is it? Where?
Sir, I'm just asking you about the DOJ policy you referred to.
A policy that goes beyond just the attorney general.
Is that policy in writing somewhere?
I think so.
So did you not consult it before you came before this committee knowing we would ask you questions about
that? Well, we talked about it. The policy is
based. Did you ask that it would be shown to you?
The policy is based on the principle that the president...
Sir, I'm not asking about the principle. I'm asking when you would be asked these questions and you would rely on that policy.
Chairman,
did you not ask your staff to show you the policy that would be the basis for you refusing to answer the majority of questions that have been asked of you?
Should be allowed to answer the question.
Jennifer Rubin, what did you make of that exchange and John McCain stepping in there, stepping on the Democratic senator from California, a woman?
This is the second time that Kamala Harris, who is a woman, an African-American woman, a Democrat, has been cut off by a Republican member. And whatever their intention, it looks terrible. I don't know what they hope to accomplish by this. They look like bullies. They look like they are offended in some fashion or can't handle the really a very appropriate, tough questioning of a woman senator. And I think they should sit down and look at themselves and see how badly they come across. I do think, however, that you hit the nail on the head. The kind of questioning that he got from the Republicans was, in many cases, ludicrous. They are not interested in getting to the truth. They're interested in acting as surrogates for the president, at making excuses, at distracting the issue. What comes to mind is that preposterous cabinet meeting, which they all sat around and offered flowery praise. I mean, if that's what the United States senators want to do, why don't they put in their application and become sycophants in the cabinet? Their job is to get to the bottom of this, to exercise proper oversight. And it is incredibly disturbing to see people like Senator Tom Cotton, people like Roy Blunt, and Risch of Idaho, act as sort of defense lawyers for the president and for Mr. Sessions. That's not their role. And if they can't provide oversight, if they can't do their job as a co-equal member of the government, then what's the rationale for Republicans being in charge of the Senate? They're supposed to be constitutional conservatives. They're supposed to be restraining the executive. They're supposed to be asserting the privileges and the prerogatives of the Senate. And they're not doing their job. So I thought it was really a dismal show, just from sort of a constitutional perspective yesterday, as you saw the executive branch show contempt for the Senate. Republican senators show contempt for the process, and you sort of wonder what the heck is going on and who is representing the American people in all of this.
Jennifer Rubin with The Washington Post, please stand by. Jonathan Landay, national security reporter for Reuters. Jonathan, thank you very much for your insight. In a word, will Sessions go before Bob Mueller? Will Bob Mueller's team be questioning him?
We'll have to wait and see, but I think it's conceivable that they will.
Jonathan Landay with Reuters, thanks very much for being with us. When we come back, we'll look at Senate Republicans and their secret planning for a new U.S. health care plan. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I want to turn now and look at what's going on with Senate Republicans' secret drafting of a new health care plan for the country. Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, wants a vote before the July 4th recess on a plan to answer what House Republicans have already passed, their own version of a bill. But Senate Republicans are not sharing what they're planning as the days tick down. Why are Senate Republicans making American health care policy in secret? What would you like to know as we get closer to a potential vote here? Here's a little sound. This is Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah at a Senate Finance Committee last Thursday, coming under fire from, or really complaint, from Missouri Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill. And he's saying, look, we invited you here to talk about these things. And she points out what's, I guess, pretty clear that, in fact, there's not a real conversation going on. The deliberations are behind closed doors.
We've invited you to participate.
When you say that you're inviting us, and I heard you, Mr. Secretary, just say we'd love your support, for what? We don't even know. We have no idea what's being proposed. There's a group of guys in a back room somewhere that are making these decisions.
Well, that is kind of the deliberate path that's being taken here. In the Senate. Still with us from Fairfax, Virginia, in this hour is Jennifer Rubin, conservative blogger for The Washington Post. She writes the Right Turn blog there. Joining us as well right now from Washington is Mary Agnes Carey, partnerships editor, senior correspondent covering health care reform for Kaiser Health News. Mary Agnes Carey, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So what do we know about what's going on with Senate Republican planning for their, I guess, answer to the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare?
Well, as you noted, they are meeting behind closed doors. There's a working group of about 13, 14 Senate Republican members. They've been also going to their caucus at the policy lunches every Tuesday, talking to them about particular options. Senator McConnell, who you referenced before, told reporters yesterday, when we're ready, you'll see it. You'll have time to read it. It will go to the floor and action will be taken. But they are getting pressure because this is not going through what they call regular order, the committee process, where it would go to Senator Hatch's committee, Finance Committee, and other committees of jurisdiction in the Senate before it heads to the floor. They are skipping that in the interest of time, and they're working from a House As we know, the House Republicans passed their version of this. The Senate is expected to change it significantly. But the fact that things haven't been made public, that there isn't a working draft, people haven't seen things, it's definitely putting pressure on the Republicans.
How does this compare or contrast with precedent when it comes to openness or closed doors on a legislation of this enormous scale, Mary Agnes?
It is not unusual for members to be behind closed doors trying to hammer out what they want to do. We saw it in the creation of the Medicare prescription drug law in 2003. We saw it there were lots and lots of committee hearings on the Affordable Care Act when it was being drafted, and markups and floor action. But there were times Max Baucus, for example, who was head of the Senate Finance Committee then, was trying to get Republicans to come on. They kept calling it the Gang of Six, and we spent hours in the hallway waiting for people to come out and talk to them. So usually it's a hybrid. Closed-door meetings, committee discussion and markups, floor action. The chambers, the Senate and the House, often pass different versions. You have an open conference, and there's lots of time. That's, again, what we call regular order to look and examine. But this is not where the Republicans in the Senate appear to be heading. The bill will come out before they go to the floor. There'll be lots of scrutiny, whether it matches Senate procedure. And, of course, the Congressional Budget Office, the official scorekeeper, will make their analysis of the bill known.
I mean, you say lots of scrutiny, but the July 4th recess is just around the corner now. Here we are. It's the middle of June. Can there really be lots of scrutiny? I recall months and months, was it a year plus, of the Affordable Care Act being—
Exactly.
That's quite a different timetable.
It is. I think there's a couple of things. Number one, the timetable, I think, is going to slip. I don't think the Senate is going to pass something before the July 4th break. They're starting to sort of make nods to that and murmurs. Anything can happen, of course, at any time. This is the Senate. But now the thought is perhaps this would slip beyond the July 4th break, and they'll be looking to try to pass something at the end of July. So that seems to be where things are going.
Maybe a little
and
more
as you
time.
Noted, Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Just a little more time to talk about. I wanted to get Mitch McConnell in here, his voice anyway, saying, you know, look, it's coming. Near future. Here was McConnell.
We're getting closer to having a proposal that we'll be bringing up in the near future. I'm not going to go into the various component parts of the health bill. We believe we can do better than the status quo. We don't think you can have the status quo. It's unsustainable.
Unsustainable, but near future, but not talking about what's in there. Very closed-lipped. You've got President Obama's former head of Medicare saying that the GOP is using sabotage, speed, and secrecy to pass an Obamacare repeal. Jennifer Rubin is with us from The Washington Post. Jennifer, headline on your recent column was, "A Party Afraid of Doing Its Job in Plain View." Is it fear, or is this just a tight timetable and difficult politics, and better to hammer it out in private and then, you know, roll it out for the whole country to observe in its glory?
Well, if time were the only issue, that would be one thing. But obviously, they put an artificial time limit on themselves. There's no reason why it has to be done by July. As you correctly identified, we had a process of 11 months, numerous hearings. The president traveled around the country talking about the details of health care. We had that very famous hearing where Republicans got to question the president in a sort of summit setting. None of that has gone on here because I think there's a fundamental problem, and that is the Republicans cannot agree amongst themselves. There's relatively little that, for example, Ted Cruz and Susan Collins share when it comes to health care. And I think meeting in private is one way of sort of disguising this fundamental divide. I don't know that a bill is ever going to come out of the Senate, let alone be agreed to by the House. We saw a little bit of that in the House side, and they eventually just threw in the towel, voted on whatever they had there, and pushed it over to the Senate. Ironically, the president, who held a celebratory event in the Rose Garden, has now called that health care bill that the House struggled to come up with mean. So that's not a great incentive for Republicans to go out on a limb. If the president of the United States is going to turn around and stab you in the back when it turns out that what you've put out there is a bunch of junk. So I think the problem is the Republicans are divided. They don't know what they want to offer. What the president talked about is not achievable, a health care bill that does not require taxes, that covers everyone, that's cheaper, that's better. This monster or this fantasy doesn't really exist. And third of all, their general approach is not one that the American people favor. American people, and this is including Republicans, overwhelmingly oppose cuts to Medicaid. They overwhelmingly oppose a rollback on the minimum list of benefits that are afforded. So I think their idea of what improvement would be doesn't jive with what the American people want. And so they're stuck. They're trapped. And they do what politicians do when they're trapped, and that is they go to ground. They go into hiding. And I think they've got a mess on their hands. And I would not be surprised, I've sort of predicted this all along, that the Republicans will never come up with a bill to, quote, repeal and replace Obamacare. Mm. And I think they're going to be under a lot of pressure to start propping up the exchanges, which in many cases are down to one or no insurers around the country.
The exchanges that facilitate the Affordable Care Act. The president of Milwaukee yesterday, of course, you're right, he came out and I think yesterday, the last day or so, called the House plan, which he had celebrated, but he called it mean. But in Milwaukee, he said this is all about Democrats' obstruction.
We will come up with a solution and a really good one to health care. No matter how good it is, we will get no obstructionist Democrat votes. No matter how good it is, if it's the greatest health care plan ever devised, we will get zero votes by the obstructionists, the Democrats.
Mary Agnes Carey, that's the president's portrayal of this, but Jennifer Rubin says, look, Republicans can't agree on this. What about that? What's the fundamental divide or opposing views that make this so hard for the GOP internally? And what do we know about how that might be playing out, Mary Agnes?
Well, as Jennifer noted, there's a lot of opposition to this dramatic shift in Medicaid funding that's in the House bill, where instead of states being matched on what they spend on a percentage basis, they'd get a set amount of money. That's a problem. This idea of the ability in the House bill for states to apply for waivers to charge people more if they had a gap in their health insurance, that's a problem. You've got Republican senators Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins who have said they don't like the prohibition on Planned Parenthood funding for a year. There are just about every step of the way, there's divides within the Republican Party on how to proceed. And Jennifer made an excellent point earlier. The House bill, they just kind of passed it and moved it over to the Senate, left it on their doorstep. I think Mitch McConnell would love to just get this thing off his doorstep. So he's got to be able to get consensus under Senate rules called reconciliation. They do only have to get 50 votes, and Vice President Mike Pence could bring in that additional vote to break the tie. But Republicans only have 52 votes in the Senate. So they've got problems with the moderates I just mentioned. They've got some problems with the conservatives who don't want to make changes that others in their party would favor. So it's really a tough lift for Senator McConnell and the Republicans in the Senate at this point.
Let's go to Senator Susan Collins territory, Maine, Presque Isle, Maine. Isaac is calling. Hi, Isaac. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I just wanted to say that Senator Susan Collins is doing actually, I think, a really good job down there for the people of Maine. Anyway, we are one of the oldest states in the country. There's a lot of elderly people here that through Obamacare were, you know, paying a lot for their health coverage and different things like that. My mom is a single mom with two kids, and every year her through Obamacare, her coverage went up $100, $100 more, and things like that. So what she's doing, I know that she's a moderate, obviously, down there. Within the Republican Party, it's going to be tough to find create a bill that's going to cover everyone. So obviously they do have to work together, and I think they can do it just because they know how Obamacare has failed, basically.
Isaac, let us pick it up right there, if you'll permit me. And I really appreciate your call. I'll take it to my guest, Mary Agnes Carey. So Isaac's in Maine, Susan Collins State, and he's worried about the elderly in Maine, his own elderly mother, and what's happened to her, I guess, premiums under the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. What is likely to happen under a Republican package?
Well, what the Senate Republicans want to do is modify the House bill structure to try to make some of this financial assistance to help you buy premiums stronger for low-income people and older Americans. That's part of the problem. The current Affordable Care Act links those subsidies to help you buy health insurance, mostly to, you know, to your income. And the House would really change that to sort of an age-based formula where younger folks get a smaller amount of money than someone who's older. So,
but we saw that the premiums for the elderly would go up, I thought, 3-4 times or more.
That's right.
Under the House plan.
In the House bill. So what the Senate Republicans are looking at that, they've seen the heat the House Republicans have received. They look at states with folks that perhaps don't qualify for Medicare at this point, but they're in their 50s, their early 60s. How do we help them? That's where some Senate Republicans say we've got to make those subsidies more generous. But that costs money. That can make the bill more expensive. And for example, the House Republican plan would scrap all the taxes that are in the Affordable Care Act. And then so you might have to have a slower phase out of those taxes to have more revenue to pay for more generous subsidies in the House Republican plan. But that's where you're going to get pushback from Ted Cruz and Mike Lee and Rand Paul, all conservative Republicans that want those taxes gone.
Jennifer Rubin, in the House, Republicans could lose, you know, 20-some of their own in the vote and still get it through. In the Senate, they've got to have everybody, I guess, on board, but two, they could lose two at the most. Can they pull this off, Jennifer? Can even inside, even behind the closed doors, can they come to unanimity or nearly?
Well, the caller is very lucky. He has Susan Collins as a senator. If there were 52 Susan Collinses in the United States Senate, I have no doubt they would come up with something. These are, you know, she is one of a handful of people who is really very conscientious, interested in compromise, understands this issue of older Americans who are not yet Medicare ready, but who have a real issue. She's very sensitive to the issue of rural Americans. Maine is a relatively rural state, and they come out the losers in the health care bill. The problem is that she's the exception, not the rule, in the Republican conference in the Senate right now, and her ability to sway people like Rand Paul, people like Mike Lee, is relatively limited. And I think the difficulty for someone like the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, who would love to get onto issues like tax reform, maybe even infrastructure, other issues that are arguably more popular, is that he's stuck dealing with this issue. And until he can get it off his desk, even if it's a vote that fails, I don't think he's going to be able to get to the rest of his agenda. And that's a problem for the Republicans. That'll be a problem for the Republicans who have to stand for election in 2018. What are they going to show to the voters? What have they accomplished? So I think he is in a real pickle here. On one hand, his group can't agree. On the other hand, until they agree, he can't get on to other things.
Mary Agnes Carey, have you counted noses? How does it look? Can McConnell pull it out? Can he, even if he can't do it by July 4th, you say it may go deeper into the summer, can he come up with a bill that his own party will agree on and be able to push through?
So one thing about Mitch McConnell, people will tell you he is a great listener. He talks to his caucus. He's very personable. He has an excellent track record of getting his caucus to go with him. So we'll see what happens. But I think that he will be pushing very hard. And if he needs, if he can't pass it before the August break, Jennifer's right. He's going to have to make this calculation. How much time do I spend on health care? How do I get to tax reform? Which is the bigger return in the 2018 midterms? All those things are in play.
You're saying he might still pull the plug on the effort?
Who knows? I mean, I think that there may come a time where he decides, I've spent enough of time on health care. I can't get a consensus. I want to move on to tax reform. I'm not saying that's going to happen.
Yep.
I'm just saying it's one of the options.
Who knows? Maybe the operative phrase today is all of this going on behind very tightly closed Republican doors. Mary Agnes Carey with Kaiser Health News. Thank you very much for being with us and all your insights today, Mary Agnes. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jennifer Rubin at The Washington Post writes the Right Turn blog there. Jennifer Rubin, great as always to have you. Thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for all your calls and comments. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.